Did your date lose the handcuff key? Hello, my name is Will, and this is Exploding Helicopter, the podcast that's just rediscovered its jump shot. Now, there was a time when conspiracy theories were the preserve of a small number of weirdos and loners who lived on the fringe of society. It all seemed very harmless. Today, national news channels endlessly amplify and regurgitate those lunatic ideas, and the conspiracy nuts all now seem to be running for elected office. How the hell did we end up here? Anyway, before I completely depress myself, let's go back to a simpler age, a time when conspiracy theories were a bit of what-if fun. So on this show, we're going to be taking a look at a conspiracy thriller in the form of 1997's Shadow Conspiracy. To help me review the film, I am joined by a man who never goes out in public without his tinfoil hat. Joining me from the grassy knoll, it's Nick Rehack. Welcome back, buddy.
Thank you for having me, Will.
It's good to have you here. Now, I have rather jokingly introduced you as a conspiracy nut, but it did make me wonder, you know, are there any conspiracy theories that you actually, you know, believe in or have some time for?
There's a handful of them. Some of them are really aggressive and depressing, so I won't talk about those. But some of them are kind of fun. You know what I mean? Like the idea of like lizard people. Like it's completely absurd. But you see some people going down their little rabbit hole posts of like, look how they look in this picture versus this picture. And like, look how their neck folds a certain way here, but not over there. Like, you know, it's lizard people with human skin on. And those are the ones where it's kind of a laugh and you're having fun. And I always try to keep it surface level. I never want to find myself 2-3 hours down the line reading on the same topic and getting like deeper and deeper and kind of losing that grip on reality. Like I said, there are a couple that are a little more on the intense and not fun podcast side, but hey, lizard people's always good for a laugh, right?
Well, you know, as long as they don't turn out to be real, I think I can find the potential of lizard people amusing. I think the reality might be a bit too sobering for me to think about, but you know, it's good to know that you've got some space in your life for these ideas, because then I guess makes you sort of you know, a potential demographic for the film that we're going to be talking about.
Exactly.
You want to believe, don't you?
I absolutely want to believe.
Okay, I think it's time to get stuck into Shadow Conspiracy. But before we do that, let's listen to old Thunderthroat himself, the great Don LaFontaine, narrate the trailer.
They met in secret. They forged an alliance. They spoke of treason.
Bobby Bishop, please.
Mr. Bishop's unavailable.
I must speak with him immediately.
It's a matter of life or death. Something terrible is happening inside the government at the highest level.
A White House aide.
They killed Yuri Pachenko.
Where are you? I'll come get you.
An investigative reporter.
Professor! Listen, Amanda, that conspiracy piece you wrote, Bobby Bishop says he can confirm that story.
Holds a piece of the puzzle.
Who are your sources?
Bobby, what just happened?
Something about Shadow.
To a conspiracy.
Bobby, I've been ordered to bring you in. Where are you?
That could topple the government.
Pachenko tried to warn me about something going on at the White House.
Together, they have less than 12 hours to unravel a mystery.
God, Bobby, what are we gonna do?
There's a chance I can stop him.
The future of the country is in our hands.
Shadow Conspiracy.
Charlie Sheen plays a presidential aide who runs into an old professor who tells him of a secret plot to assassinate the president. But before Sheen can learn anything more, his friend is shot and killed. Charlie then turns to an old friend who works as a reporter at an influential newspaper. After they uncover a conspiracy to kill many high-level government officials, they must race against time to stop the murderer. In the cast, we have Charlie Sheen, Linda Hamilton, Donald Sutherland, Stephen Lang, Ben Gazzara, Sam Waterston, and Gore Vidal, of all people. This film was directed by George P. Cosmatos, who helmed Rambo, First Blood Part 2, Cobra, Tombstone and the delightfully bonkers Escape to Athena, Shadow Conspiracy was not a critical hit, with reviewers describing it as bland, interminable, and repetitive. It's not particularly popular with ordinary punters, as the film has a user rating of just 4.9 on IMDb. And the film wasn't even popular with two of its stars. Charlie Sheen said he hated this film, and Linda Hamilton's opinion was just as scathing, describing it as really bad. Interestingly, this film sat in the can for 18 months before it was finally released in 1997, which is usually the sign of a film that the studio thinks has a few problems. Anyway, with all of that out of the way, Nick, what did you make of Shadow Conspiracy?
It's tough to pinpoint because there's a lot that the film has a lot of potential and there's a lot of ways it could go. But I think tonally, it just doesn't know what it wants to do because there's a lot of things that, okay, we're serious and this is a serious thriller. And then there's other moments where it's like, okay, when's the gag going to happen? When's the bit going to come through? Because there's some things that I don't understand it. Like in the very beginning of the film, right, we have a group of professors hanging out, and then here comes Stephen Dorff coming through, or Stephen Lang coming through, and he's just going to start wiping people out. And then we cut to a basketball game in Baltimore, and we're never back in Baltimore again. So it's like, why did we – what are we doing over here? And then every time they meet, it's always one of those like cliche settings where the camera's on a character in the background. It's a huge like historic monument or a national building. Or they're in some kind of like grubby little alleyway with chain link fences everywhere. It hits all of these cliche points. And so you're thinking, okay, here comes the bit. Here comes the joke. And then it doesn't happen.
Yeah, I think I know what you mean. Because it looks like a film. It sounds like a film. Yet you sort of prod it a little bit. And there's just really nothing of any sort of substance there. I mean, it's... it's kind of strange that, I mean, this film is absolutely chock full of action and there's loads going on within it, but it's such an insubstantial film that you just don't really care about anything that is going on, you know, within it. And for a film that's actually meant to be a conspiracy thriller, there is a surprisingly little amount of conspiracy sort of going on within it, and it's a bit like what's that old saying about sort of empty vessels make the loudest noise. I think Shadow Conspiracy is definitely of that particular ilk. I mean, there's loads of whizzes and bangs going on within this on the screen, it makes a lot of noise, but there's just nothing of any kind of substance to it, and it's just a sort of ultimately a really disposable movie.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate too because there's a lot that could have been done with it. And even if you look at the performances, I don't even think the actors know if it's supposed to be serious or a comedy, because you have Charlie Sheen and Linda Hamilton, they're really selling it. Stephen Lang, he's silent throughout the film, so you're kind of wondering, like, when's he going to say something, when he's going to do something. But then you got Donald Sutherland, who's supposed to have this stressful job, and he's just so blasé. They're always worried about, like, what about Bobby Bishop? He's like, oh, he's fine. Don't worry about it. It's going to be okay. And Donald Sutherland's a way better actor than that. Like, he could really command and be like, no, got it. He could raise his voice or something, but he just doesn't. It's like, oh, okay. Oh, I guess he's like Snuffleupagus almost, and everybody's trying to figure out what the hell's going on.
I think Donald Sutherland is a bit better than that in this movie. I mean, I think he realizes this is not a good film, and there are quite a few moments where within the film where I feel like he's enjoying himself, even despite the fact that he knows this is not going to be a film that many people are going to be talking about when they are writing the writing my obituary or anything. But it's kind of interesting that you bring him up, because there was an element of this film that I did want to kind of get your view on, which was, what do you think sort of Donald Sutherland like fancied Charlie Sheen? Because like within this film, like, for those that haven't watched it, Donald Sutherland, he's meant to be kind of like Charlie Sheen's like mentor, like who's kind of groomed him to be this really slick political operator. But I guess that's kind of what Donald Sutherland's probably going for with his vibe. But there's quite a lot of scenes where he seems really excited to be in Charlie Sheen's company. And I don't know. It feels like it's gone past the Plutonic point into a bit where Sutherland is almost kind of, you know, it's almost like Charlie Sheen's making him a bit randy.
You know what? Now that you say that, it kind of clicks, especially towards the beginning of the film. They meet up at a bar and they're having drinks. And if you take the sound off and just watch them talk, the way Sheen's eyes are, like, looking at Sutherland, and the way Sutherland smiles back at him, I'm like, oh, okay, this is – they're buddies, okay. Like, they're – we out here.
They're flirting.
It's – that's so –
This date is going really well.
It's almost too well, and he's looking around. He's like, oh, the stars are out, and look at your eyes and how they sparkle, and – it's a really nice setting too. It's kind of this outdoor venue, and it's really well lit, and it's just fancy all around. And
but Sutherland's always talking up, like he's talking up even when he's not in the company of Charlie Sheen. He's talking him up. So, you know, when he's with other characters talking about him, he's got to, you know, he's my man. He's my man. I've got to protect him. Or he's kind of saying, you know, Bobby Bishop's the only man who can kind of, you know, straighten out the president on this.
And here's the thing, he can talk him up in all these buildings and stuff, but what does he actually do? He's all of a sudden he's speaking in front of the press, and then he's just out, you know, shooting guns and running away from people and trying to, like, talk to the president about a speech or, like, hey, maybe – like, I don't know what his position is. And I think it's that and not having nailed down other facets of the film that just kind of – they set stuff up and then they just don't talk about it. Like there's a scene where they're in a Jeep and a character's having a hard time getting out of the seatbelt. And they're like, oh, here, let me get that for you. It's a little tricky. Now one would think, okay, later on, there's going to be a chase or there's going to be a character in that seatbelt that can't get out. Someone's going to take a dive out of the Jeep. Jeep's going to hit a wall and explode or do something and that character's dead, but nothing ever comes from it. So it's like, why are we talking about this seatbelt? I can't think of his name, but shortly after the dinner scene, when Charlie Sheen meets up with Amanda Gibbons, Linda Hamilton's character, I think it's Jorgen is his name?
Yeah.
Yeah. Where's Jorgen? Jorgen shows up. He's like, hey, what's going on? And then leaves.
Jorgen is Linda Hamilton's sort of briefly glimpsed boyfriend. Is that the character you're thinking about?
Yes.
I mean, that's a strange part of the film. I don't know why they bothered to include that. And also the casting of Jorgen was very strange as well, because he looks like he should be – he looks a bit like who's Hans Gruber's main sidekick in Die Hard? I forget his name. But he really looks like that guy with the long hair who's stalking Bruce Willis throughout that film. But, let's talk about one of the other characters in this movie. We've got Stephen Lang playing – this hitman who is working for the kind of the villains in this particular film, and he is completely mute throughout the whole film. So he is silent, and he just strides around the film in this very conspicuous ankle length white trench coat, which I don't know what you thought, Nick. I thought. Probably, you know, if I was a top assassin, I probably wouldn't wear a coat that is quite so distinctive if I was going about my job trying to kill people discreetly.
Oh, absolutely not. I'm trying to blend in. And here's what's even weirder. He's got that big trench coat. It's not like he's got some, like, crazy tactical outfit on or something to store a lot of weapons. It's literally a T-shirt tucked into a pair of jeans. There it is. So why not just bomb around in that? You know what I mean? Like, what's the sense of this jacket? It's almost like they're trying to make this, like, intimidating Terminator-type character because he's silent and he's kind of methodical and specific on how he'll, like, move his head. But I'm just like, what are you doing with this jacket? It's a nice jacket, don't get me wrong, but I'm – I don't get it.
It's not what you choose if you want to blend in. But you mentioned the Terminator, and I've got that as a note, which is, you know, he is giving off something of a Terminator vibe in this film. And obviously we've got Linda Hamilton, who, you know, was famously been pursued by the Terminator through multiple films. So, mm-hmm. you know, I wonder if that will lay behind her particular casting here. But Stephen Lang, I find, he's an interesting actor in the sense that he's been around for a long time now. And I guess it's sort of more towards the back end of his career that he's got sort of more prominent roles, in films, things like Avatar and Don't Breathe. But he's got a long career going back to the 80s. And one thing is really bizarre, you know, because I was looking through his filmography, is I don't think there are many actors who look so different at the beginning of their career as they do at their end, because I saw that he was in the film Manhunter, which I know is a favorite of yours.
Love Nick, Manhunter.
Nick. And, he looks completely different in that film than he does in the sort of later stages of his career. And I think what it is it's his curly hair. He's got phenomenally curly hair. Yeah. In Manhunter, it's an absolute shock of tight curls. And I saw him in another film recently, Guilty as Sin, which is directed by, what's his name? Can't remember. Sidney Lumet directed that. And again, really curly hair. It looks completely different. He's sort of, it's almost like the early part of his career belongs to a different actor, because he just looks so different. And I can't put the two, like the current day Stephen Lang together with the kind of the films that he was making back in the 80s and 90s.
No, because even with curly haired Stephen Lang, his whole persona is completely different too, not just even his visual appearance. When he's in Manhunter, he's this kind of slick, snide reporter, just a real cheesebag journalist, not even that. And that's just who he is, kind of weaselly. And if you look at him in other films, he kind of gives off that same vibe. But as soon as the curly hair is gone and like the facial hair comes out, he's like cool and calm and collected. He can play, you know, a president. He can play a military type figure that he's ended up playing a lot in his later career. But sometimes it just takes people that second half. Like look at Christoph Waltz. He didn't do a lot. And then you play a Nazi and bam, yeah. you're back in it and everybody loves you, you know?
One thing I also wanted to test with you is, like, did you, you know, were you reminded of, that Clint Eastwood film In the Line of Fire when you were watching it? And, you know, I asked this because there's, you know, in that film, as in this film, there's this whole business of a ruthless assassin sort of moving towards the president. In that film, he sneaks into an event that the president's attending. In both films, the killers employ toy modeling in order to perform their hit. And in both films, balloons play an important part at sort of crucial moments. So, do you think I've built up my case sufficiently, Nick?
I can definitely see that. But for me, the one thing that kind of stuck out a little bit more was like Enemy of the State.
Okay.
Just
yeah.
not as
not well done as that.
Good. Yeah, there, it's a perfect. Not as well done, exactly. And a little taste of Baltimore there in both of them. But yeah, there's something about it's like a healthy combination of the two. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm. Now, this is a conspiracy thriller, and the film even has conspiracy in the title. But I'm going to put it to you, Nick, that this is a conspiracy thriller without actually a conspiracy. I mean, sure, the plotters want the president dead, but can you actually tell me why they want him dead?
The only thing I can think of is from the very beginning, he's talking about a speech and he wants to cut military spending and he wants to make these radical changes. And I think it's the powers that be are just happy with the status quo. Anytime the country is at war, it makes more money for government friends and political friends, sure, but still more money in general. So I think that's the conspiracy, is that this president's going to make radical changes and improve the lives of society for the better. They don't want it, so they're going to take him out. But even then, if they're just finding out about this speech, how would it – assumedly, this plot would have taken some time to put it together. So why bring him all the way in just to do that conspiracy bit? You know what I mean? That's the only thing I can think of, is just he's making radical change and they don't want it. But even then, like, is that really a good enough reason? Hey, you're making changes. Rather than stifle him politically or do a gridlock like they would at the Capitol, just
– yeah.
I don't know.
I completely agree. There is this mention, as you say, there's this mention of he's going to basically freeze these contracts, but they're never quite really defined like what those contracts are for, and it's certainly not clear like why – are so many members of the president's like senior cabinet like against the freezing of these contracts. Like, I guess the implication is they've got their snouts in the trough, there's some sort of kickbacks going on, but it's yeah, never it's never mentioned, it's never fleshed out. And as you were saying, given that so many senior members, the vice president's against it, the chief of staff's against it, there's that early scene, like loads of other like political heavyweights in the room, they're all against it. So like, there's no way if all of these people in the president's own government are against it, he's never going to get this through the Senate. He's never going to get this through Congress. I mean, as you say, why do they need to bump off the president? They just jam him up in the legislature, and you know, nothing would change, nothing would happen, and you wouldn't have to you wouldn't have to hire trench coat wearing hitmen to take out the president.
Yeah, and it's not like we know, you know, this is his second term and he's kind of losing grip and everybody's like, okay, well, let's hold on a second, and they start to reel him in. We don't know where he is in his term, but even so, the vice president, he's kind of picking his running mate, so you think they'd have some stuff in common, or at least he'd be on their side. The president also picks his own his own cabinet members. The president picks the cabinet members, and then they're confirmed by the Senate. So, like, why would he pick all these people that are against him? Now, I could see trying something where it's like, hey, we don't agree on everything, but we agree on this. Yeah. Let's bring some different ideas and compromise to the table. Sure. But so radically to where they're like, yeah, we got to kill him.
There's no possible alternative. Yeah. But there are quite – I mean, that's just one of many sort of rather silly and stupid sort of moments in this film. And, you know, I don't want to go through them all here. It'd be too depressing. So, yeah, I just want to ask you kind of like, what was your dumbest moment in this film?
That's a bold – honestly, the basketball scene in the beginning. Because
– of all the scenes, Nick, of all the scenes –
I know, and that's the one that's taking place in Baltimore too. So you think I'd be like, oh yeah, all for it. Because as soon as – after they all get shot up, excuse me, during the basketball scene, right?
Mm.
All of a sudden it cuts to this satellite image zooming in. And I'm looking at it. I'm like, that doesn't look – and all of a sudden it hits. And I'm like, oh, that's Baltimore. Wait, does this take place in Baltimore? And I got a little excited. Then there's this basketball scene for no reason. It's just a guy – shooting hoop, not just a guy, but it's Charlie Sheen's character. He's shooting hoops with a lot of other players who actually were part of the Washington basketball team at the time, the DC Wizards. So, well, they were the Bullets, but then they became the Wizards. Either way, he's playing with some pros, which is pretty cool. But even then, it's like, wait, why are we doing this? Like, there's no need for it. Here's what's even weirder. If you look at the satellite photos, maybe I'm misreading it and I don't know how to read satellite photos properly, but it almost looks like it's kind of snowy, right? It looks cloudy. Everything's got like speckles of white. If you pause it at just the right moment, you can kind of see roughly where my parents' home would be satellite wise. I could point to you where I work from the satellite image. I'm very familiar with where they are.
I tell you what, Nick. As part of promoting this podcast, I'm going to capture the freeze frame of that satellite image, and I'll email it to you. And what I'd like you to do is mark on the satellite image like where you work and your parents' home, and we'll put that out as part of the content for this episode. How about that?
All for it. I'll absolutely do it. Yeah, man.
I'm going to pick you up on a slight point here, because you're sort of like wondering, why have we got this basketball scene in the film? And I think there's a very obvious reason why, because actually basketball is used here as a metaphor for the growth of of Charlie Sheen's character, because the first time we meet him, as you say, he's playing basketball, and he's really annoyed to be interrupted by the kind of chief of staff calling him up, interrupting his basketball game, because as he tells him, I've just rediscovered my jump shot. And we see him like draining like a three pointer from a good healthy distance. And then at the end of the film, when the conspiracy's been thwarted, Charlie Sheen's turned down being the president's chief of staff because he wants to take this job being like sort of secretary of state in charge of like this sort of like social house building project. So, he's kind of, I'm not about me and my career. I just want to do some good. And we meet him at the end of the film. He throws a basketball at the hoop and it sort of, he rims it, he misses, and he's completely relaxed about it. And I think it's meant to show the change that he's been through in this film, that, at the beginning of the film, he's this self-centered character. All he cares about is kind of manipulating politics in order to kind of preserve the, gender of the president. And he's all about making sure, how's my jump shot doing? How's my basketball game? Whereas at the end, I'm about other people. If my basketball game's gone to hell in a handbasket, As long as I'm helping the deserving poor out there, I'm cool with that. So I think it's about him and his personal growth. It's a metaphor, Nick.
You know what? It works, and I'm mad that it works. Like, I don't want that to be a thing, but no, you're absolutely right. Like, unfortunately, I have to agree with you. I don't want to. But
you don't want to? No. I will take. I will take you conceding the point, even if it's grudgingly. I'll
grudgingly for sure.
I'll take that, stick it in my back pocket. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be looking at the exploding helicopter action.
She was an American scientist on an expedition in Africa, but when she discovered a plot,
there's no way this could happen naturally.
To take over the country.
Of course, you do know about the prediction. The water will go bad and people will die.
She had to be silenced.
Got some bad news, Jeff.
What her captors didn't expect.
Tell him you can't do anything?
Was a visit from her husband.
I really need to help on this.
Where's my wife, Houston?
And he would stop at nothing.
I gotta find her, man.
To get her back.
We'll find her.
He was outnumbered.
My resources might surprise you.
Outarmed.
Let's see how good you are.
Outranked.
A real screwed up mind to figure out this little game.
Outrageous. And out of control. Lethal Ninja.
We're back, and now we're looking at the exploding helicopter action. This occurs at the climax of the film. The president is attending a children's charity fundraiser. This allows Stephen Lang's hitman to enter the venue, carrying what appears to be a present for one of the children attending the event. But in actual fact, the gift turns out to be a remote-controlled toy helicopter equipped with machine guns, which suddenly emerges out of its wrapping in the middle of the ceremony. The helicopter opens fire on the guests as Lang pilots it towards the president in order to bump him off. To avert the assassination, Charlie Sheen is forced to improvise and yanks at a cord that releases a net filled with party balloons. These fall down on the helicopter, causing it to crash into the ground and suddenly explode. Nick, what did you make of the exploding helicopter action?
Well, when I was watching this movie, every so often we'd see a helicopter in the distance. And I'm like, okay, here we go. This is it. And then it just wouldn't be. We're getting towards the end of the movie, and I'm like, man, is the helicopter just going to come through the building? Like, what's going to happen here? So when all of a sudden I see Stephen Lang pull out a little remote, and it cuts to the box, and a helicopter shows up, I immediately start laughing. This is – it might be my favorite exploding helicopter that I've looked at since doing this show. But it was so absurd. It was so absurd to see this buzzing around. What's even more absurd is the size of the explosion. Like, it is balloons that kind of hold and drop onto this helicopter. It forces it to the ground. The propeller stops. And you would kind of think that's it. It just kind of peters out. The motor burns up. Oh, no. Oof, big explosion. Balloons are popping everywhere. It's just big and orange, and it's the whole nine. But what's even more, like, absurd is Stephen Lang's just kind of hiding behind a post. No one's noticing, like, hey, there's that guy with the remote. Stop him. He's just kind of, like, standing there maniacally. He doesn't try to hide anywhere. He just I do like the camera work. I like how we go from shots of, like, point of view of the helicopter to watching the helicopter come sliding in. There's a lot of ammo on that helicopter, too.
Yeah, like, it makes no sense, does it? It makes no sense how much ammunition there is on that helicopter, because it's not big. I mean, it's the box he's carrying it is, you know, fit, he's just carrying it very easily under his arm. Mm-hmm. but somehow it's got like some sort of, you know, mini guns worth of ammunition in there.
Yeah. And I'm just like, because I thought maybe, okay, he's got like some guns in there. Or he's got a little mini arsenal. He's going to start taking people out. But no, it's just it's a children's helicopter that he's outfitted with machine guns. But then the more I think about it, why were there balloons there to begin with? It's a children's fundraiser, right? It's not a political speech. It's not some big announcement where the balloons come down and they play Celebration. Like, why were there so many balloons there? Like, what?
Well, I mean, you've got questions. I've got questions because, you know, I was wondering, well, how is Stephen Lang going to kind of escape after pulling off this particular hit? Because, you know, the president's security detail are all there. I mean, they obviously proved to be completely ineffective during this particular sequence. So, you know, maybe he's just relying on their incompetence to be able to safely escape. But equally, you know, if this is a conspiracy thriller, who are they going to pin the blame on? Like, you know, you would think, well, if we're gonna this is a conspiracy thriller, you'd think they'd have some sort of patsy, you know, set up as a fool guy, or, you know, they would want to pin the blame on some group who've, you know, got nothing responsible for this incident, but would further the aims of the, you know, the people behind this particular conspiracy. But you know, which he's just going to bump off the president with a toy helicopter, and yeah, we're not going to worry about how he escapes. We're not going to worry about who gets the blame for this. It's a sequence that raises an awful lot of questions, I think, with the viewer, if assuming that you haven't sort of mentally checked out of the movie by this point.
See, I didn't even think of that. The only thing I can think of is if the helicopter goes in one direction, explodes. Lang is in enough of a suit where he can kind of duck out the side and pretend like he's a staff member or something like that, or just force his way out, because he's done that the whole thing in the very beginning when he starts chasing Charlie Sheen. He goes to an elevator, just yanks this woman's hair, rips her in an opposite direction to get onto the helicopter. So he's not afraid to just forcefully remove people from the situation so he can continue on about his, you know, wrath. But yeah, at the same time, like, if that were to fall apart, who's the fall guy? Who's the patsy? Mm. Who's the Lee Harvey Oswald, if you will?
Yeah, definitely. Now, we always like to tell you, our listeners, about points of interest about the helicopter explosions that we see in films that we are reviewing. And, you know, some of you might be wondering, like, you know, is this a unique exploding helicopter in a film? Is this, you know, this is a kind of like toy model aircraft helicopter that is exploding here. So, Nick, how many other films do you think there are where, you know, model helicopter aircraft explode?
I'm going to say over 5, under 10.
Well, you're not, you know, just shows you how your knowledge of exploding helicopters is growing, whether you like it or not, because you're not a million miles away. There's actually only two other films which have exploding model helicopters in. So there is a Joe Dante film. I don't know if you've seen Small Soldiers.
Yes. Oh, my God. Yes. Oh, man.
That has a good one. That has a good one in. And then there is an amazing one from a 1987 film, I think it is, with Fred the Hammer Williamson, called The Kill Reflex, where it's a really I'll send you the clip, Nick.
The
it's a
Kill
really
Reflex?
Yeah. I mean, it also has an alternative a title called Soda Cracker, which I'm I'm slightly wary of quite what's meant behind that title, but the sequence is really amazing because Fred Williams faces down a helicopter, but it's shot in the style of a Sergio Leone spaghetti western. So we see Fred Williams facing down this helicopter and like close up of his eyes, close up of his hand hovering over the kind of the butt of his pistol. It's a very bizarre sequence, but are you ready though, Nick, to continue your exploration of films with exploding toy helicopters?
Oh, I am. And now that you've said Toy Soldier or Small Soldiers, I really want to go back and rewatch that movie because I used to watch that a lot, a whole lot on VHS. So I'd have to rip back into there and see what's going on.
Well, Nick, you may have chosen the next film that we do on the podcast.
Not against it.
Okay, I think that just about wraps things up for this show. Nick, thanks for joining me once again. Before you go, do you want to plug anything in particular?
Yeah, just two quick things. I was on the Movies, Films, and Flicks podcast with Mark Hoffmeyer, and we discussed scenes where a character jumps in slow motion to catch something or someone. Episode 451. We had a lot of fun there. And recently I've been showing up more and more on the Lambcast. Will, you and I were just on the episode for Movie of the Month where we discussed the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, a film that I championed in a conversation that I guess hosted. And I had a lot of fun. And yeah, check those two out. Movies, Films, and Flicks and the Lambcast.
As always, don't forget to check out the Exploding Helicopter website for more reviews and information about films where helicopters explode. We'll be back soon. But until then, keep watching the skies for those exploding helicopters.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Boy, oh boy, you are some kind of big shot.
I could have sworn it was just last week you were stuffing envelopes and licking stamps.
That was last week.
You gotta try some of this vodka that Vin sent us. It's fantastic. A couple of good shots and you're Eric the Great.
Eric the Great never made it to 60. I, on the other hand, am alive and going strong simply because I have always restricted myself to slowly sipping Old Reliable.
And eating apple pie and making love like a missionary. Sailing that yacht of yours around the Chesapeake.
I tell you, Bobby, when I'm out on that bay, all the crap that we go through every day just to try and keep this country from going under washes off me, and I look back at that shore and my mind is clear, crystal clear, and I rediscover Virginia the way it used to be. God, that sounds like Thomas Jefferson, doesn't it?
Ah, Jake, we kicked some butt today.
You did, Bobby.
Gets the first soundbite win.